A penny saved may well be a penny earned, but I need you to think about the macroeconomic impact here, people. Also, fresh homemade tortillas. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 23rd of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a little bit of, well, that's good, I think. According to the people who keep track of this stuff, which in this case is the U.S. Department of Commerce, Americans are saving more. So far this year, we are saving more than we have since before the recession, which is good, I think, because something's going on here. Usually, when an economy is growing, as the American economy is, people save less, not more. But here we are in the longest economic expansion we've ever had, and people are saving. Marketplace's Andy Euler has this look at what's going on.
If people are saving money, they're doing it for two main reasons: retirement, and if they're uncertain about their economic future.
What we're really seeing is more of the second effect happening.
That's Kent Smetters. He's an economist at the Wharton School of Business.
People face a lot of uncertainty, you know, about the future, and people are, have increased their precautionary saving.
He says we're also only 10 years removed from the Great Recession, so people could still be scarred from that. The propensity to save breaks down by income level. Higher-income households tend to save more. Those people also benefited more from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics.
Big chunk of that tax cut for high-income households just went into people's savings accounts.
And the saving is happening at a time of unprecedented economic expansion. So it seems the fruits of that expansion aren't really getting to a lot of lower-income households. And while saving is generally encouraged, if it outstrips investment over the medium or long haul, it could backfire. Gauti Egertsen teaches economics at Brown University.
Investment, which in equilibrium has to be the same as savings, is not really picking up much. And that has sort of given rise to worries about what people have termed as secular stagnation.
He says conventional wisdom is that the government can step in and spend to help stimulate the economy. Now, this could happen via a stimulus plan or infrastructure spending. But that, of course, also has a hefty price tag. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Look, the economy is complicated. Just witness that savings rate story Andy just did for us, right? And we know that sometimes, try though we might to help you understand it, we throw business and economics at you pretty fast. So today, a new series in which we slow way down and go back to basics. We're calling it, and this was not my idea, we're calling it Kai Explains.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
Our first installment is something we talk about all the time.
The rate of inflation.
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 Inflation. Inflation.
Could you whip up a little more inflation, please?
We talk about inflation all the time because it matters. It's a key measurement of where the economy might be headed, how consumers are doing day to day, and it's what Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve spend so much time trying to keep stable. So, what are we talking about when we talk about inflation?
Well, the way most people think about inflation is when the prices of goods and services that they buy go up.
That's Erica Groshen. She's a visiting scholar at Cornell University, also a former commissioner at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which calculates the Consumer Price Index, or CPI.
So we have about 400 people across the country who collect about 80,000 prices per month of pretty much anything that, you know, you or your household might purchase.
That is Steve Reed. He is currently at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He says he's not the CPI guy, but
I am a CPI guy.
Steve says those 80,000 items include a whole basket of stuff: bananas and televisions, haircuts, prescription drugs, rent, gasoline, college tuition as well.
And when people use the CPI, what they're often using is the change in that index, which could be defined as inflation.
And when the CPI comes out every month, there is a headline number that tells you how much the prices of those 80,000 items in the basket have gone up or down. And then there is another number. It's called the core number that intentionally leaves out food and energy prices, which can bounce around a whole lot.
So increases in those particular goods, you know, may not reflect, you know, long-term pressures. They may just be reflecting weather patterns or things like that.
Former BLS Commissioner Erica Groshen one more time talking CPI. But because nothing in economic reporting is ever easy, when we talk about inflation, we also have to talk about the Federal Reserve, which means there are three more letters you need to know.
PCE. So PCE stands for personal consumption expenditures. It is also sometimes referred to as consumer spending.
That's David Washausen. He's the chief of the National Income and Wealth Division at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the agency that calculates PCE. Also, and not for nothing, they're the people who calculate GDP, too.
I think the relationship between the PCE price index and the CPI would be that of tight cousins. They largely tell the same story from period to period.
But, as I said, nothing in economic reporting is ever easy. So in 2000, the Federal Reserve announced that PCE, not CPI, but PCE is the measure of inflation it is going to use to set its inflation target.
One reason the Fed likes to look at that price is because it can be fit in that GDP framework. And so they can look at what is the economy doing? Is it hitting a target growth? And then let's look very specifically at those prices that are paid by consumers in that same exact framework and see how that gauges our target inflation.
August PCE numbers, remember that's what the Fed uses, comes out at the end of this week, so you can channel your inner Jay Powell and try to guess what the Fed is going to do next. No, don't. It's too hard. Leave that to the professionals. Tell us what you want me to explain next. You can do that at marketplace.org or hit me up on Twitter. I am at Kai Rysdahl, KaiRysdahl. On Wall Street today, sideways, mostly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It seems to be going from bad to worse for the shared office space company WeWork. Its long-planned initial public offering was shelved indefinitely last week. And now there's a fight brewing inside the company. In one corner is founder and CEO Adam Neumann, pretty much the archetype of the charismatic yet somehow quirky visionary behind a Silicon Valley startup. In the other, members of the company's board, which is to say the money behind WeWork, who have decided, in hopes of salvaging the IPO and thus their exit, that Neumann needs to go. As Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, in battles like these, money talks. And sometimes it says a visionary founder needs to walk.
Think about Steve Jobs at Apple, Elon Musk at Tesla, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook.
With some companies, they are so intertwined that people think the company is the founder.
That's Eric Gordon at the University of Michigan. Adam Neumann's vision for WeWork requires billions in venture capital investment, and the investors who provided it want to ensure that Neumann can shift from an ideas guy to the CEO of a public company. Michael Youssim is a management professor at the Wharton School.
There are doubts that he has the capability to not only invent the product, but then to sustain the product.
Those doubts are reportedly coming from the venture capital giant SoftBank, which has poured over $9 billion into the company, making it WeWork's biggest investor. UC Berkeley Law Professor Stephen Davidoff-Solomon says that gives SoftBank some serious leverage over WeWork.
If they're feuding with their largest shareholder, no one's going to invest in them, and they are going to crash and burn very quickly.
Neumann has some leverage, too. He owns special shares, which give him a lot of say over what the company does. But WeWork lost $1.6 billion last year, and it needs more investment to keep expanding.
This is just a giant game of chicken where Adam Neumann holds the initial cards, but to continue forward, he needs to find financing.
Uber went through something similar in 2017. Its board forced out founding CEO Travis Kalanick prior to the company's IPO. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Also not having a great run right now, but with substantially less angst and wringing of hands on Wall Street than with WeWork, American farmers caught as they are in the middle of the trade war, which, that bit about being caught in the middle, is interesting because when it started, the trade war wasn't really about American agriculture, but the government's bailout payments to farmers have put them front and trade war center. Mario Parker covers ag for Bloomberg News. Mario, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me, Kai. I really appreciate it.
So remind me, was agriculture one of the industries that these tariffs were supposed to help?
In the long run is the short answer. Farmers largely stood behind President Trump's trade war with China with the expectation that there would be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow vis-a-vis large sales of crop purchases by China.
But what's happening here is that the sales aren't happening because of the tariffs, but there is money going to the farmers.
Sure, absolutely. The trade war has gone on now more than a year. Just speaking with farmers, the expectation was that it wouldn't have lasted as long as it has. Last year, the administration doled out some $12 billion. Somewhere toward the end of that, end of last year, USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue made a comment that there wasn't an expectation for more aid to be doled out in 2019. But here we are with another $16 billion allocated to farmers.
Which, as you point out in the piece, is a total of $28 billion, which makes this aid operation, if you will, more expensive than the Detroit bailout during the financial crisis.
Sure, absolutely. Some of that money for the with the Detroit bailout crisis was paid back to taxpayers. This isn't at all a loan. Think more along the lines of maybe a grant or some such that doesn't have to be paid back.
Right. When you talk to farmers, I mean, certainly we've got our farming regulars that we talk to here. What are your folks telling you about whether they'd rather have the money or the business?
They'd rather have the business. Now, the farmers that have supported President Trump are largely conservative Republicans. So the idea of this type of aid package kind of flies in the face of their ideological beliefs. Farmers have also over the years had to beat back negative PR about subsidies and the like and trying to kind of educate the public. This does them no favors in that regard either. They'd rather have trade, not aid, is the mantra, at least out here in farm country. And these payments, while it's $28 billion, they say that it in no way makes them whole.
You mentioned the president. He is still incredibly politically popular in the Farm Belt.
He is indeed. What you're seeing out here in farm country and what's being described is just tension. I mean, that there's if you could think of a rope, the rope between the president and farmers is continuing to tighten.
Mario Parker covers ag for Bloomberg News. Mario, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Kai. Really appreciate it.
Coming up,
I would say maybe anywhere between 6,000 to 10,000 tortillas.
Big appetite or big business? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 14 points today. That's less than a 10%, 26,949. The NASDAQ basically unchanged, 81.12. The S&P 500, same, 29.91 there. Apple is going to avoid some tariffs by assembling its new Mac Pro desktop computers in Austin, Texas. That is a reversal of a plan to shift manufacturing to China. Apple picked up 0.4%. Boston Beer rose 2.7% today after Guggenheim raised its share price target for the Sam Adams Brewer. Guggenheim cited strong growth from Boston's spiked seltzer water brand called Truly. Truly. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace helps you stay sharp on all things related to business and the economy. And to help you do some numbers of your own, you can get your very own Marketplace pencil pack when you become a Marketplace investor today. It's a set of six pencils, each stamped with a different Marketplace quote, yours for a donation of just $5 a month. So please support public service journalism and get your pencil pack today at marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The center of worker activism in big tech moves this week from Silicon Valley to Pittsburgh, where contractors at the Google campus are organizing. The group, it's about 100 people or so. They are officially employed by a staffing firm, but they work on Google projects. The group is going to be voting on union membership tomorrow. Google and a whole lot of tech companies lean real hard on temps and contractors who work right next to full-time employees doing the same job sometimes, just with lower pay and none of the benefits. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that story.
The cushy life of tech workers has become the stuff of satire. Employers offering free meals and on-site spas, not to mention premium healthcare and stock options. But many workers are literally excluded from these perks, says Jeffrey Buchanan with the labor initiative Silicon Valley Rising.
Yeah, it's quite common to see when you walk into a major tech campus here in Silicon Valley, two sets of name badges. Those workers who are directly employed, and then the subcontracted, temporary workers.
A temp badge means you often don't get into important all-staff meetings, holiday parties, or trainings. Contractors frequently don't have health care or paid time off. And they've become more widespread over the last decade, says Pradeep Chauhan, who runs On Contracting, a service that helps match contractors with temporary positions at the biggest tech companies.
It used to be that companies used to use temps or contractors for people that might be going on vacation or maternity leave.
Now, he estimates 40 to 50% of the labor force at major tech companies are subcontractors. According to internal documents from Google recently obtained by the New York Times, contract workers outnumber permanent employees at the company. But a flexible workforce has always been a feature of the tech industry, says Margaret O'Meara, who wrote The Code, Silicon Valley, and the Remaking of America.
Part of it has to do with the nature of the business that needs to upsize and downsize quickly.
After pressure from workers this spring, Google agreed to guarantee contract workers certain benefits like health care and paid time off. But the jobs still don't have the security and wages of full-time employment, let alone the free meditation classes. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We're going to go across town now, over to a neighborhood called Boyle Heights in East Los Angeles, to a tortilla factory, Tortilleria, I learned they're called. Two guys, Rick Ortega and Omar Ahmed, friends since high school, now partners at Kernel of Truth Organics, organic non-GMO American-grown corn to put into tortillas as a business proposition.
We should say, by the way, I mean, tell us where we are. We're in a storefront. On what is that, Cesar Chavez here in Boyle Heights?
Cesar Chavez. We're in Boyle Heights, which is what we like to call tortilla country out here, because there's a lot of tortillerias out here.
So you got competition?
It depends. We have friends. We have friends and neighbors. Because at any given time, either of us may need a piece of equipment, a string, anything. And we really use each other and each other's resources to get through the night.
And the night is when you do most of your making, right? So that things are fresh in the morning?
Everything ships out fresh.
Everything ships out fresh.
Everything. How many, like, in a night? How many, give me a sense of scale.
In tortillas, well, if you want to multiply, like, 5 times 12, I would say maybe anywhere between 6,000 to 10,000 tortillas.
A day?
Or per whatever. Production.
Per production.
Per production, yeah.
Seems like a lot. Is that a lot? Are you guys a big tortilla maker?
Actually, it's a little bit.
It's a little. When you look at it in terms of packs, it starts to look a lot less.
And who do you ship to? Who are your customers?
The vegan food scene was really where we were thrown into.
Looking for the organics, right?
Yeah, they wanted to ensure that the tortilla that they were buying was not compromised. And with me, they found that ability to actually get the product they want to specification.
Right.
So back then, nobody wanted to do it. In fact, today, nobody still wants to do it because there's just too much of a problem, hassles, and not profitable enough.
It's early in the morning, so you're not, fully up to speed here yet. But come show me what you can show me, and we'll talk through the process.
We'll do a quick tour. So just watch your head coming up. Right. So you're a little taller than us. I'll show you immediately our tortilla oven or our cutters, our tool belt, which we have when we have
those
different molds.
Shapes of tortillas, right. You got the big ones and you got the small ones, right? Is that basically the deal?
Yeah. Then you have our tortilla oven, our cutter, which is pretty much kind of like our musical instrument. You have to tune it. You have
that's a good analogy.
Different thickness. You actually have tuning pegs. We use...
Literally, it looks like it could be on a guitar.
Yeah, it's literally a guitar.
It
came off a guitar, right?
It came off a guitar.
That's pretty funny.
So whenever you want to get either a thinner tortilla or a thicker home-style tortilla, we'll adjust it to weights. They get cooked on the plancha there. They go down.
I didn't really understand tortillas were that complicated.
They don't have to be.
They don't have
pure corn.
Yeah. Yeah. When it's pure corn, it's just, you know what? Grind the corn, make the masa, throw it in here, press it, watch
and
it go down.
And then box it up. So what are you doing now? Is there a bunch of corn like soaking or something?
What we're doing is grinding some of our blue corn. You can see.
Oh wow.
So this is actually corn that has been nixtamalized for over 18 hours.
So basically it soaks, right?
It soaks, and with the calcium hydroxide, it's pretty similar to pickling lime.
So blue corn goes in.
Yes.
This, honestly, it's kind of a gray-looking mush, right?
Yeah.
Comes out, and then that eventually is just going to get fed into the conveyor belt.
That's
is
it.
Is that the deal?
Yeah.
Pretty much?
So from kernel to dough to tortilla.
Where do you guys get your corn? What's the supply chain?
That was hard when we started. It was really hard to find the type of corn that we needed because...
But there's so much corn in this country, man. I mean, you know...
But it all gets shipped out. And it's actually very little kept in-house for corn producers such as ourselves and what we use it for.
Right.
So at first we were working with a small family up north, right? And then from there we started sourcing in Illinois and Nebraska, which is kind of like the corn Bible Belt.
Right.
Corn Belt of the United States.
So now you've got your suppliers out there, and they just, however often it is, corn shows up on the doorstep.
However we need it, but it's fickle because it's also dependent on climate, whatever adversity they face.
So all that flooding out there this past spring, is that an issue for you guys?
Yeah, we actually, one of our providers let us know we're not going to have the corn that you guys want until the next crop, which will be early, maybe next year.
But you're like, I got to make tortillas, man. I got orders coming in.
Yeah, that's when Omar and I get on the phone and start harassing everybody. What can we do? We need corn now.
So it's 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, sir.
How long have you guys been here?
Well, this is kind of like our nighttime. Really, right now we should be sleeping.
Yeah.
And then we get up around 2 p.m., get here around the 4 or 5, get everything ready, grind by 7, finish by 1 a.m., load up the vehicles, take off throughout L.A., sometimes San Diego.
Are you guys doing the deliveries too?
Thankfully, myself, not anymore. I just had a daughter not too long ago.
Oh, congratulations.
So there's some things that I'm
But you're
glad
up in the middle of the night anyway, man. So.
For different reasons.
Yeah. He's still up in the middle of the night.
Yeah. But no, I myself are not delivering anymore.
Right.
But sometimes if somebody calls off and we don't have an extra guy, Rick will have to go ahead and assume the responsibility of getting the tortilla to that client.
We're luckily now finally amassing our team.
Right.
And really it's friends and family.
Yeah, I was just going to say, who are you hiring? I mean...
It's more like, who are we asking for a help?
Yeah.
And it's always friends and family.
Yeah.
I want to make this my bread and butter, which it is right now. This is how we live. So whatever it takes, we'll do it. And I think that's kept us in the spotlight now. It's, you know, word's getting out. These guys will do whatever it takes to get to their restaurants.
Rick Ortega and Omar Ahmed, small business owners of Kernel of Truth Organics. Their tortilla is coming eventually to a store near you. Final note on the way out, which I'll set up by saying you've probably already heard at least part of this next piece of audio elsewhere today, and we try real hard not to double you up like that, but this one is A, important, and B, right in our wheelhouse. 16-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg at the United Nations this morning.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet, you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
All right, we got to go. A whole lot of flatty, flat, flat, flat on Wall Street today. Dow Industrials up 14 points, less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ and the S&P 500 basically unchanged. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.